exposed as a scoundrel. To this day, I don't know whether he'd started committing crimes by the time I began my research. My report surfaced when the Senate Ethics Committee opened hearings into Keating's connections to five senators, who came to be known as the Keating Five. John McCain, one of those being investigated, testified that my assessment had helped reassure him about Keating. I told the New York Times that I was embarrassed by my failure to foresee what the company would do, and added, I was wrong about Lincoln. The incident was doubly painful for me because it caused trouble for Andrea. By this time, she had become her network's chief congressional correspondent, and she was covering the Keating scandal. Andrea had always taken extreme care to keep what she called a firewall between my work and hers as our relationship deepened. For example, she never attended any of my congressional testimonies. She strove to avoid even the appearance of a conflict of interest. The Keating hearings put this to the test. Reluctantly, Andrea decided to take herself off the story while the news media explored my connection to the case. No one knew how much the final cleanup of the thrift industry would cost taxpayers. The estimates were in the hundreds of billions of dollars. As the work proceeded, the drain on the Treasury was perceptible, worsening the fiscal challenge for President Bush. The job of trying to recoup some of the losses fell to the Resolution Trust Corporation, which Congress had created in 1989 to sell off the assets of the ruined companies. I was on its oversight board, which was chaired by Treasury Secretary Brady and included Jack Kemp, then the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, real estate developer Robert Larson, and former Fed Governor Philip Jackson. The RTC had a professional staff, but for me, by early 1991, being on the oversight board was almost like having a second job. I spent large amounts of time poring over detailed documents and attending meetings. The vast numbers of uninhabited properties we managed were deteriorating rapidly from lack of maintenance, and unless we moved quickly to get rid of them, we would end up with one huge write-off. Moreover, we would probably have been saddled with a bill to tear a lot of them down. I kept adding up the cost in my mind. It was not a pretty thought. S&L mortgages that were still paying interest had sold off readily in the market. But now the RTC had gotten down to the assets nobody seemed to want. Half-built malls in the desert, marinas, golf courses, tacky new condo complexes in overbuilt residential markets, repossessed half-empty office buildings, uranium mines. The scope of the problem beggared the imagination. Bill Seidman, who chaired both the RTC and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, calculated that if the RTC sold off $1 million of assets a day, it would need 300 years to sell them all. Clearly, we needed a different approach. I'm not sure who came up with the creative sales idea. As we finally presented it, the plan was to group the properties into $1 billion blocks. For the first package, which we offered at auction, we especially solicited the bids of a few dozen qualified buyers, mostly businesses with track records of turning around sick properties. Qualified doesn't necessarily mean savory. The groups we approached included so-called vulture funds and speculators whose reputations could have used a facelift. Only a few bids materialized, and the package went for a comparative song, just over $500 million. What's more, the winning bidder had to make a down payment of only a fraction of the price and then pay installments based on how much cash the properties generated. The deal looked like a giveaway, and as we'd expected, public watchdogs and Congress were outraged. But there's nothing like a bargain to stimulate demand. Large numbers of greedy investors rushed to get in on the action. The prices of the remaining blocks of property soared, and within a few months, the RTC's shelves were stripped bare. By the time it disbanded in 1995, the RTC had liquidated 744 S&Ls, more than a quarter of the industry. But thanks in part to the asset sales, the total bill to taxpayers was $87 billion, far less than originally feared. Commercial banks also were in serious trouble. This was an even bigger headache than the S&Ls because banks represent a far larger and more important sector of the economy. The late 1980s was their worst period since the Depression. Hundreds of small and medium-sized banks failed, and giants like Citibank and Chase Manhattan were in distress. Their problem, as with the S&Ls, was too much speculative lending. In the early 80s, the major banks had gambled on Latin American debt. And then, as those loans went bad, Like amateur gamblers trying to get square, they'd bet even more by leading the whole industry into a binge of commercial real estate lending. The inevitable collapse of the real estate boom really shook the banks. Uncertainty about the value of the real estate collateral securing their loans made bankers unsure how much capital they actually had, leaving many of them paralyzed, frightened, and reluctant to lend further. Big businesses were able to tap other sources of funds, such as innovative debt markets that had sprung up on Wall Street, a phenomenon that helped keep the 1990 recession shallow. But small and mid-sized manufacturers and merchants all over America were finding it hard to get even routine business loans approved, and that in turn made the recession unusually difficult to snap out of. Nothing we did at the Fed seemed to work. We'd begun easing interest rates well before the recession hit, but the economy had stopped responding. Even though we lowered the Fed funds rate no fewer than 23 times in the three-year period between July 1989 and July 1992, the recovery was one of the most sluggish on record. The U.S. economy is best described as moving forward, but in the teeth of a 50-mile-an-hour headwind, was how I explained the situation to an audience of worried New England businessmen in October 1991. I couldn't be very encouraging, because I didn't know when the credit crunch would end. I would see President Bush every 6 or 7 weeks, usually in the context of a meeting with others, but sometimes one-on-one. We had known each other since the Ford years. He'd even had me over to Langley for lunch when he was Director of Central Intelligence in 1976. During the early months of the 1980 campaign, he often called me on economic policy issues. While Bush was vice president, I would join him every so often at the White House. He was intelligent, and in person we always got along well. I was particularly taken with his wife Barbara, a spunky and formidable presence. But during his presidency, he was far less focused on the economy than on foreign affairs. Though his father had worked on Wall Street and he'd majored in economics at Yale, he had never experienced the markets firsthand. He didn't think of interest rates as being set mainly by market forces. He seemed to believe that they were matters of preference. It was not a thoughtful view. He preferred to delegate economic policy to his top aides. This meant that I dealt mainly with Nick Brady, Dick Darman, and Mike Boskin. Darman, the budget director, was in many ways similar to David Stockman, a major league policy intellectual and a believer in sound fiscal management. Unlike Stockman, though, Dick was often less than direct with people and was more driven by political expediency. Over time, I learned to keep my distance. Darman wrote years later that behind closed doors at the White House, he'd strenuously opposed keeping the no new taxes pledge. Instead, he tried to persuade the president to attack the deficit early on, when they might have put the issue quickly behind them. But the president wasn't convinced. As 1989 progressed, the White House found itself at loggerheads with the Democratic Congress. So much debt continued to hang over the budget that when the recession came, the administration didn't have the fiscal flexibility to address it. Before long, the administration began blaming its troubles on the Fed. Supposedly, we were choking the economy by keeping the money supply too tight. I got my first taste of this in August 1989, while Andrea and I were visiting Senator John Hines and his wife Teresa at their Nantucket summer house. We put on the Sunday morning talk shows, and there was Dick Darman on Meet the Press. I was only half paying attention when I heard him say, "It's important to not merely Chairman Greenspan, but the other members of the board and the FOMC, that they be more attentive to the need to avoid tipping this economy into recession. I'm not sure they're quite there yet." I nearly spilled my coffee. "What?" I said. Listening to his argument, I thought it made no economic sense. But then I realized it didn't have to. It was political rhetoric. Treasury Secretary Brady didn't like the Fed either. He and the president were friends and had a lot in common. Both were wealthy, Yale-educated patricians and members of Skull and Bones. Nick had spent more than 3 decades on Wall Street, rising to become chairman of a major investment house. He brought with him to Washington a depth of real-world trading experience and the habit of command. Throughout the Bush administration, Nick and I cooperated on many major issues. We traveled to Moscow in 1991 and worked closely and effectively on complex matters of bank regulation and foreign exchange. Not only did he and I work together, but he even invited me down to Augusta National to play golf, and Andrea and I socialized with him and his wife, Kitty. but he reinforced President Bush's instrumental view of monetary policy. To Nick, slashing short-term interest rates seemed a no-risk proposition. If the Fed flooded the economy with money, the economy would grow faster. We would have to stay on the lookout for a flare-up of inflation, of course, but if that happened, the Fed could rein it back in. If I had done what they wanted, I'd have pushed for faster, steeper cuts, and no doubt have had my head handed to me by the market, deservedly. The Treasury Secretary, however, was not receptive to debate. Like many traders, he'd had great success going by his gut. In matters like exchange rate policy, I found his sense of the markets quite acute. But he was not a conceptualizer, and was not inclined to take the long-term view. Nick and I would meet for a working breakfast once a week, and whenever the subject of monetary policy came up, we would simply go round and round. This impasse made coping with the deficit and the recession doubly difficult, because it meant the administration was always looking for a quid pro quo from the Fed. When the 1990 budget bill was on the table, and President Bush finally faced the necessity of breaking his No New Taxes pledge, Nick asked me for a commitment that if the budget went through, the Fed would lower interest rates. In fact, the budget package impressed me. It included a couple of Darman innovations that I thought were very promising, such as a pay-go rule, that any new spending program had to have some offsetting source of funding, either a new tax or a budget cut. Pay-go was Washington's shorthand for pay-as-you-go. The proposed budget did not cut the deficit as deeply as it might have, but the consensus at the Fed, with which I agreed, was that it was a big step in the right direction. In a congressional hearing in October, when the budget was finally up for approval, I pronounced the plan credible, which might sound like faint praise, but it was enough to make the stock market jump, as traders bet that the Fed would instantly cut interest rates. Of course, we had no such intention. Before easing credit, we needed to see first whether the budget cuts actually became law, and most important, whether they had any real economic effect. So, I was always very careful in what I privately told Nick. I said, a sound budget will bring long-term rates down because inflation expectations will fall. Monetary policy, appropriately, should respond to that by lowering short-term rates. This was standard Fed policy, but it frustrated Nick because it was not the promise he was looking for. When the recession hit that fall, the friction only got worse. There has been too much pessimism, President Bush declared in his 1991 State of the Union address. Sound banks should be making sound loans now, and interest rates should be lower now. The Fed, of course, had been lowering rates for over a year, but the White House wanted more, faster cuts. I still have a letter Nick sent me during that time. He'd taken the extraordinary step of inviting 8 prominent economists from industry and academia to the White House for lunch with the president. At the lunch, each economist was asked whether the Fed ought to further cut short-term rates. Put on the spot in front of the president, Nick wrote, every single one replied that it would do no harm, and virtually all felt it would help. Alan, in my travels, you stand alone in your view, the letter continued, complaining bluntly of lack of forceful leadership by the Fed. In the event, the administration's bark was worse than its bite. As my term as Fed chairman ended in the summer of 1991, there was a behind-the-scenes meeting in which the Treasury Secretary was fishing for a commitment to further relax monetary policy in exchange for a second term. Nick later claimed I had made such a deal. In fact, there was no way I could commit to that, even if I had wanted to, and even though I privately thought our rate decreases might continue. Nonetheless, President Bush reappointed me. I think he concluded I was his least worst choice. The Fed itself, by all accounts, was functioning well. There was no other candidate whom Wall Street seemed to prefer, and a change would have roiled the markets. The impasse on monetary policy made it hard for Nick and me to remain friends. Though we continued to cooperate professionally, he canceled our weekly breakfasts, and our socializing came to an end. With the election year nearing, the administration decided to change its approach to the Fed and its pig-headed chairman. The Greenspan account, as they called it in the White House, shifted to CEA Chairman Mike Boskin and the president himself. The recovery was, in fact, finally picking up steam as the campaign season began. By July, I felt confident enough to declare that the 50-mile-per-hour headwinds had partially abated. Later analysis showed that by spring, GDP, which in 1990 replaced GNP as the standard measure of aggregate output, was growing at a healthy 4% annual rate. But that was hard to discern at the time, and the president, understandably, was concerned that the growth be as robust and obvious as possible. I met with the president only a handful of times that year. He was always extremely cordial. "I don't want to bash the Fed," he'd say. He'd probe and raise substantive questions based on what he'd been hearing from his business contacts. He'd ask things like, "People are saying restrictions on bank reserves are part of the problem. How should I be looking at this?" These were not questions Reagan would have raised. He had no patience for discussing economic policy, and I was delighted that Bush wanted to know. I felt a lot more comfortable dealing with him than I did with Brady because the discussion was never adversarial. But when we talked about interest rates, I was never able to convince him that lowering rates further and faster almost certainly wouldn't have speeded the recovery and would have increased the risk of inflation. The fact was, the economy was recovering, just not in time to save the election. The deficit probably hurt Bush worse than anything else. Although the belated budget cuts and the tax hikes of 1990 had put the country on a somewhat better fiscal footing, the recession cut so deeply into federal revenues that the deficit temporarily mushroomed. It hit $290 billion in the last year of Bush's term. Ross Perot was able to hammer at that in the campaign and succeeded in dividing the Republican vote enough to sink Bush. I was saddened years later when I discovered that President Bush blamed me for his loss. "I reappointed him, and he disappointed me," he told a television interviewer in 1998. It's not in my nature to be suspicious. I realized only in retrospect the extent to which Brady and Darman had convinced the president that the Fed was sabotaging him. His bitterness surprised me. I did not feel the same way about him. His loss in the election reminded me of how voters in Britain had ousted Winston Churchill immediately after the Second World War. As best I could judge, Bush had done an exemplary job on the most important issues confronting the United States, our confrontation with the Soviet Union and the crisis in the Middle East. If a president can earn re-election, he did. But then, so did Winston Churchill. Chapter 6. The Fall of the Wall. It was October 10, 1989. Jack Matlock, the U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union, was introducing me to an audience of Soviet economists and bankers at Spasso House, the ambassador's official residence in Moscow. My assignment was to explain capitalist finance. Of course, I had no notion that in a month the Berlin Wall would be torn down, or that in a little more than 2 years the Soviet Union would be no more. Nor did I know that I would, in the years following the Eastern Bloc's collapse, become witness to a very rare event, the emergence of competitive market economies from the ashes of centrally planned ones. In the process, the demise of central planning exposed the almost unimaginable extent of the rot that had accumulated over decades. But the biggest surprise that awaited me was an extraordinary tutorial on the roots of market capitalism. This is the system with which, of course, I am most familiar, but my understanding of its foundations was wholly abstract. I was reared in a sophisticated market economy with its many supporting laws, institutions, and conventions long since in place and mature. The evolution I was about to observe in Russia had occurred in Western economies scores of years before I was born. As Russia struggled to recover from the crash of all the institutions related to the old Soviet Union, I felt like a neurologist who learns by observing how a patient functions when a part of the brain has been impaired. Watching markets try to work in the absence of the protection of property rights or a tradition of trust was a wholly new experience for me. But that was all ahead of me as I looked out at the 100 or so people assembled before me at Spasso House and wondered, what are they thinking? How can I reach them? They were all products of Soviet schools, I assumed, and deeply indoctrinated with Marxism. What did they know of capitalist institutions or market competition? Whenever I addressed a Western audience, I could judge its interests and level of knowledge and pitch my remarks accordingly. But at Spasso House, I had to guess. The lecture I had prepared was a dry, diffuse presentation on banks and market economies. It delved into such topics as the value of financial intermediation, various types of risk commercial banks face, the pluses and minuses of regulation, and the duties of central banks. The talk was very slow-going, especially as I had to pause paragraph by paragraph for the translator to render my words into Russian. Yet the audience was quite attentive. People stayed alert throughout, and several seemed to be taking detailed notes. Hands went up when I finally reached the end, and Ambassador Matlock opened the floor for questions. To my surprise and pleasure, the ensuing half-hour of discussion made it obvious that some people got what I was talking about. The questions they asked revealed an understanding of capitalism that startled me in its sophistication. How did these people know so much? In 1991, I finally asked Grigory Yavlinsky, one of Gorbachev's top reformers. He laughed and explained, "We all had access to books on econometrics in the university libraries. The party ruled that because these were mathematical works, they were purely technical, devoid of ideological content." Of course, the ideology of capitalism was embodied in many of the equations. Econometric models revolve around the driving forces of consumer choice and market competition. Thus, Yavlinsky said, Soviet economists had become quite knowledgeable about how markets worked. I'd been invited by Leonid Abalkin, the deputy prime minister in charge of reform. I'd expected our meeting that week to be largely ceremonial, but it turned out to be anything but. An academic economist in his late 50s, who was one of Gorbachev's kitchen cabinet of reformers, Abalkin had built a reputation for political flexibility and grace. His long face made him look as if he was carrying a lot of stress, and there were plenty of reasons for that to be the case. Winter was setting in, there were reports of looming electricity and food shortages, Gorbachev was talking publicly about the risk of anarchy, and the prime minister had just asked the parliament for emergency powers to ban strikes. Perestroika, Gorbachev's ambitious four-year-old economic reform initiative, was in danger of collapse. I sensed that Abalkin had his work cut out for him because his boss understood so little of the mechanics of markets. Abalkin asked my opinion of a proposal being touted by the Soviet state planners. It was an inflation-fighting program that revolved around indexation, tying wages to prices, as a way to reassure the population that the purchasing power of their wages wouldn't be destroyed. I told him briefly about the U.S. government's ongoing struggle to foot the bill for having indexed Social Security benefits and volunteered my strongly held view that indexing is only a palliative that, in the longer run, is likely to cause even more serious problems. Abalkin didn't seem surprised. He said he thought that the transition from bureaucratic central planning to the private market, which he called the most democratic form of regulating economic activity, would take many years. Fed chairmen had ventured behind the Iron Curtain before. Both Arthur Burns and William Miller had come to Moscow during the period of détente in the 1970s, but I knew they'd never had a conversation like this one. In those years, there had been little to discuss. The ideological and political divide between the centrally planned economies of the Soviet bloc and the market economies of the West was simply too vast. Yet the late 1980s had brought astonishing changes, most obviously in East Germany and other satellites, but also in the Soviet Union itself. Just that spring, Poland had held its first free elections, and the ensuing events had amazed the world. First, the Solidarity Union won decisively against the Communist Party, and then, instead of sending in the Red Army to reassert control, Gorbachev declared that the USSR accepted the outcome of a free election. More recently, East Germany had started to dissolve. Tens of thousands of its people took advantage of the state's weakening hold to emigrate illegally to the West. And just days before I arrived in Moscow, Hungary's Communist Party renounced Marxism in favor of democratic socialism. The Soviet Union itself was obviously in crisis. The collapse of oil prices a few years before had eliminated its only real source of growth, and now there was nothing to offset the stagnation and corruption that had become epidemic during the Brezhnev era. Compounding this was the Cold War, whose pressure was greatly increased by America's huge arms buildup under President Reagan. Not only was the Soviet Union's grip on its satellites slipping, but also it was having trouble feeding its population. Only by importing millions of tons of grain from the West was it able to keep bread on the shelves. Inflation, Abalkin's immediate concern, was indeed out of control. I had seen with my own eyes long lines outside jewelry stores, where customers desperate to convert rubles into goods with lasting value reportedly were being restricted to one purchase per visit. Gorbachev, of course, was moving as rapidly as he could to liberalize the system and reverse the decay. The General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union struck me as an extraordinarily intelligent and open man, but he was of two minds. Intelligence and openness were his problems, in a way. They made it impossible for him to ignore the contradictions and lies the system presented him with day in and day out. Though he'd grown up under Stalin and Khrushchev, he could see that his country was stagnating and why, which unraveled his indoctrination. The big mystery to me was why Yuri Andropov, the hardliner who preceded Gorbachev, had brought him forward. Gorbachev didn't bring down the Soviet Union purposely, yet he did not raise his hand to prevent its dissolution. Unlike his predecessors, he did not send troops into East Germany or Poland when they moved toward democracy. And Gorbachev was calling for his country to become a major player in world trade. Without question, he understood this was implicitly pro-capitalist, even if he didn't understand the mechanics of stock markets or other Western economic systems. My visit dovetailed with Washington's growing effort to encourage reform-minded Soviets under Gorbachev's openness policy, Glasnost. As soon as the KGB allowed people to attend evening gatherings, for instance, the U.S. Embassy instituted a series of seminars at which historians, economists, and scientists could attend lectures by their Western counterparts on previously forbidden subjects such as black markets, ecological problems in the Southern Republics, and the history of the Stalin era. A large part of my itinerary consisted of meetings with high officials. Each surprised me in some way. While I'd studied free market economics for much of my life, encountering the alternative and seeing it in crisis forced me to think more deeply than I ever had before about the fundamentals of capitalism and how it differed from a centrally planned system. My first inkling of this difference had come during the drive into Moscow from the airport. In a field beside the roadway, I'd spotted a 1920s steam tractor, a clattering, unwieldy machine with great metal wheels. "Why do you suppose they still use that?" I asked the security man who was with me in the car. "I don't know," he said. "Because it still works?" Like the 1957 Chevrolets on the streets of Havana, it embodied a key difference between a centrally planned society and a capitalist one. Here, there was no creative destruction, no impetus to build better tools. No wonder centrally planned economic systems had great difficulty in raising standards of living and creating wealth. Production and distribution are determined by specific instructions from the planning agencies to the factories, indicating from whom and in what quantities they should receive raw materials and services, what they should produce, and to whom they should distribute their output. The workforce is assumed to be fully employed, and wages are predetermined. Missing is the ultimate consumer, who in a centrally planned economy is assumed to passively accept the goods planning agencies order produced. Even in the USSR, consumers didn't behave that way. Without an effective market to coordinate supply with consumer demand, the consequences are typically huge surpluses of goods that no one wants, and huge shortages of products that people do want, but that are not produced in adequate quantities. The shortages lead to rationing, or to its famous Moscow equivalent, the endless waiting in line at stores. Soviet reformer Yegor Gaidar, reflecting on the power of being a dispenser of scarce goods, later said, "To be a seller in a department store was the same as being a millionaire in Silicon Valley. It was status. It was influence. It was respect." The Soviets had staked their entire nation on the premise that central planning, rather than open competition and free markets, is the way to achieve the common good. Contemplating this made me eager to meet Stepan Sitaryan, the right-hand man of the chief of Gosplan, the State Planning Committee. The Soviet Union had a bureaucracy for everything, and the key ones had names beginning with Gos, or state. Gosnab allocated raw materials and supplies to industry. Gostrud set wages and work rules. Goskomtsen set prices. At the pinnacle sat Gosplan, which, as one analyst memorably put it, dictated the type, quantity, and price of every commodity produced at every single factory and plant across 11 time zones. Gosplan's vast empire included military factories, which had access to the best labor and the best materials and were universally regarded as the USSR's finest. Indeed, the USSR's supposedly passive consumers flocked whenever possible to acquire the superior household goods produced by military factories. These consumers were as sophisticated as any in the West. In total, Western analysts estimated, the agency controlled between 60% and 80% of the nation's GDP, and Sitarian and his boss, Yuri Moskvyukov, were the officials at the controls. A diminutive man with a white pompadour and a good command of English, Sitarian turned me over to a senior Gosplan aide who trotted out elaborate input-output matrices, the mathematics of which would have dazzled even Vasily Leontief, the Russian-born Harvard economist who pioneered them. Leontief's notion was that you could precisely characterize any economy by mapping the flow of materials and labor through it. Done thoroughly, your model would be the ideal instrument panel. Theoretically, it would let you anticipate every impact on every segment of the economy from the change of one output, such as the production of tractors, or, more to the point in the Reagan era, a major increase in military production to respond to the U.S. arms buildup for the Star Wars missile defense. But Western economists generally considered input-output matrices to be of limited use because they failed to capture the dynamism of an economy. In the real world, the relationships between inputs and outputs almost invariably shift faster than they can be estimated. Gosplan's input-output model had been elaborated to Ptolemaic perfection. But judging by the top aide's remarks, I couldn't see that any of the limitations had been solved. So I asked how the model took into account dynamic change. He just shrugged and changed the subject. Our meeting obliged him to keep up the pretext that planners can set production schedules and manage a vast economy more efficiently than free markets can do. I suspected that the aide didn't actually believe that, but I couldn't tell whether what he really felt was cynicism or doubt. One might think that smart planning authorities should have been able to adjust to their model's shortcomings. People like Sitarian are smart, and they tried, but they took too much on themselves. Without the immediate signals of price changes that make capitalist markets work, how was anyone to know how much of each product to manufacture? Without the help of a market pricing mechanism, Soviet economic planning had no effective feedback to guide it. Just as important, the planners did not have the signals of finance to adjust the allocation of savings to real productive investments that accommodated the population's shifting needs and tastes. Years before becoming Fed chairman, I'd actually tried picturing myself in the central planner's job. From 1983 to 1985, I served under Reagan on the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, PFIAB, where I was asked to review U.S. assessments of the Soviet ability to absorb the strain of accelerated armament. The stakes were enormous. The President's Star Wars strategy rested on the assumption that the Soviet economy was no match for ours. Ramp up the arms race, the thinking went, and the Soviets would collapse trying to keep up, or they'd ask to negotiate. In either case, we'd hold out our hands, and the Cold War would end. The assignment was clearly too important to turn down, but it daunted me. It would be a Herculean task to learn the ins and outs of a production and distribution system so different from ours. Once I dug into the project, though, it took me only a week to conclude that it was impossible. There was no reliable way to assess their economy. Gosplan's data were rotten. Soviet managers up and down the line had every incentive to exaggerate their factory's output and pad their payrolls. Worse, there were large internal inconsistencies in their data that I couldn't reconcile, and I suspected neither could Gosplan. I reported to the PFIAB and the president that I couldn't forecast whether the challenge from Star Wars would overload the Soviet economy, and I was fairly certain the Soviets couldn't either. As it turned out, of course, the Soviets didn't try to match Star Wars. Gorbachev came to power and launched his reforms instead. I mentioned none of this to the Gosplan officials, but I was glad I wasn't in Sitarian's shoes. The Fed's job was challenging, but Gosplan's was surreal. Meeting with the head of the Soviet Central Bank, Viktor Gerashenko, was much less fraught. Officially, he was my counterpart, but in a planned economy in which the state decides who gets funds and who does not, banking plays a much smaller role than in the West. Gosbank was little more than a paymaster and record keeper. If a borrower fell behind in payments on a loan or went into default, so what? Loans were essentially transfers among entities all owned by the state. Bankers did not need to worry about credit standards or interest rate risks or market value changes, the financial signals that determine who gets credit and who does not, and hence who produces what and sells to whom in a market economy. All the topics I'd talked about the previous evening were simply not part of Gosbank's world. Garashenko was forthcoming and friendly. He insisted we call each other Victor and Alan. He spoke excellent English, having spent several years running a Soviet-owned bank in London, and he understood what Western banking was about. Like many people, he made believe that the Soviet Union was not that far behind the United States. He sought me out, and sought out other bankers in the West, because he wanted to be part of the prestigious central banking establishment. To me, he seemed totally benign, and we had a pleasant talk. Just 4 weeks later, on November 9, 1989, the Berlin Wall came down. I was in Texas on Fed business, but like everybody else that night, I was glued to the TV. The event itself was remarkable, but even more amazing to me in the following days was the economic ruin the fall of the wall exposed. One of the most fateful debates of the 20th century had been the question of how much government control is best for the common good. After World War II, the European democracies all moved toward socialism, and the balance was tilted toward central government control even in America. The entire war effort by American industry had been effectively centrally planned. That was the economic backdrop of the Cold War. In essence, it turned out to be a contest not just between ideologies, but between two great theories of economic organization: free market economies versus centrally planned ones. And for the past 40 years, they'd seemed almost evenly matched. There was a general belief that even though the Soviet Union and its allies were laggards economically, they were catching up to the wasteful market economies of the West. Controlled experiments almost never happen in economics, but you could not have created a better one than East and West Germany, even if you'd done it in a lab. Both countries started with the same culture, the same language, the same history, and the same value systems. Then, for 40 years, they competed on opposite sides of a line, with very little commerce between them. The major difference, subject to test, was their political and economic systems, market capitalism versus central planning. Many thought it was a close race. West Germany, of course, was the scene of the post-war economic miracle, rising from war's ashes to become Europe's most prosperous democracy. East Germany, meanwhile, became the powerhouse of the Eastern Bloc. It was not only the Soviet Union's biggest trading partner, but also a country whose standard of living was seen to be only modestly short of West Germany's. I'd compared the East and West German economies as part of my work for the PFIAB. Experts had estimated that East German GDP per capita was 75% to 85% of West Germany's. I thought this couldn't be right. All you had to do was look at the crumbling apartment buildings on the other side of the Berlin Wall to conclude that productivity levels and standards of living there fell far short of those in the vibrant West. The irony was that East Germany's GDP estimates did not seem out of line. The narrow spread between West and East German standards of living appeared the result of West Germany's understating its progress. Each country, for example, counted the number of cars it produced. But West German statistics did not fully capture the quality difference between a 1950 Mercedes, say, and one assembled in 1988. Meanwhile, the design of the Trabant, the boxy, pollution-belching East German sedan, hadn't changed in 30 years. So the quality-adjusted production gap between the two economies was almost certainly greater than generally thought. The fall of the wall exposed a degree of economic decay so devastating that it astonished even the skeptics. The East German workforce, it turned out, had little more than one-third the productivity of its Western counterpart, nothing like 75% to 85%. The same applied to the population's standard of living. East German factories produced such shoddy goods, and East German services were so carelessly managed that modernizing was going to cost hundreds of billions of dollars. At least 40% of East German businesses were judged so hopelessly obsolete that they would have to close. Most of the rest would need years of propping up to be able to compete. Millions of people were losing their jobs. Those people would need retraining and new work, or else they were likely to join the throngs migrating west. The extent of the devastation behind the Iron Curtain had been a very well-kept secret, but now the secret was out. At least East Germans could look to the West Germans for help. The other nations of the Soviet bloc all were suffering the same blight or worse, yet they had to fend for themselves. Poland's great reformer, Leszek Balcerowicz, was taking a page from the book of another great economic reformer, Ludwig Erhard. The economics director of West Germany under the Allied occupation in 1948, Erhard sparked the revival of the devastated economy by abruptly declaring the end of price and production controls. Erhard arguably overstepped his authority doing this, but he made the announcement on a weekend, and prices had completely changed by the time the occupation administration could react. The gambit worked. To the amazement of critics, West Germany's stores, which had been gripped by chronic shortages of food and merchandise, quickly flooded with goods, and its notorious black markets dried up. At first, prices were exorbitant, but they declined as additional supply overwhelmed demand. A Western-educated economics professor from central Poland, Balcerowicz followed Erhard's example to propose what he called a market revolution. Everybody else called it shock therapy. When Solidarity won the Polish election in August 1989, the economy was on the verge of collapse. There were food shortages in the stores, hyperinflation was destroying the value of people's money, and the government was bankrupt and couldn't pay its debts. At Balcerowicz's urging, the new government designated January 1, 1990 as the day of the Big Bang, when virtually all price controls would cease. I met him for the first time at an international banking meeting in Basel, Switzerland, a few weeks before the event, and he astonished me by saying he did not know whether the strategy would work. But, he said, you cannot reform by small steps. He was convinced that in a society where the government had dictated every aspect of buying and selling for four decades, there was no such thing as a smooth transition from central planning to competitive markets. Drastic action was required to spur people to start making their own decisions and, as he put it, to be convinced that change was inevitable. His Big Bang, predictably, brought tremendous upheaval. Just as had happened in Erhard's Germany, prices initially leaped up. The zloty lost almost half its purchasing power in the first 2 weeks. But more goods appeared in the stores, and gradually prices evened out. Balcerowicz had people constantly checking the shops, and, as he later recalled, it was a very important day when they said, the price of eggs is falling. There was no more eloquent sign that the shift to a free market had begun to work. Poland's success encouraged Czechoslovakia to try an even bolder reform. Václav Klaus, the economics minister, wanted to turn state-owned enterprises over to the private sector. Instead of trying to auction them off to investor groups, no one in Czechoslovakia had much ready cash, he proposed to distribute ownership to the entire population in the form of vouchers. Each citizen would receive an equal allotment of vouchers, which could be traded or sold or exchanged for stock in a state-owned enterprise. In this way, Klaus wanted not only to bring about the radical transformation of property rights, but also to lay the groundwork for a stock market. Klaus talked about this and many other ambitious plans in a lunchtime presentation at a Fed conference at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, in August 1990. A square-built man with a brushy mustache, he was fierce about the urgency of reform. "Losing time means losing everything," he told us. "We have to act rapidly because gradual reform provides a convenient excuse to the vested interests, to monopolists of all kinds, to all beneficiaries of paternalistic socialism, to change nothing at all." This sounded so fiery and uncompromising that when we opened the floor for questions, I brought up the impact of the reforms on people's jobs. "Are you contemplating providing some kind of social safety net for the unemployed?" I asked. Klaus cut me short. "In your country, you can afford such luxuries," he said. "To succeed, we need a clean break with the past. The competitive market is the way to produce wealth, and that's where we're going to focus." He and I became good friends, but this was the first time in my life that I had ever been rebuked for not sufficiently appreciating the power of free markets. It was a singular experience for an admirer of Ayn Rand. As the Eastern European countries raced ahead with reform, the instability in Moscow only seemed to worsen. It was hard from the West even to determine what was going on. Just a week after being elected president of the Russian Republic in June 1991, Boris Yeltsin visited New York and spoke at the New York Fed. Yeltsin had gotten his start as a construction industry boss and had been Moscow's mayor in the 1980s. Then he'd quit the Communist Party to take up the cause of radical reform. His election with a nationwide majority of 60% was a crushing defeat for communism. Though he was subordinate to Gorbachev, his popularity, coupled with his impetuousness, made him a magnet for attention. Like Khrushchev in an earlier era, he seemed to personify his country's unnerving contradictions. His first trip to the United States in 1989 had been a disaster. People remembered mostly the news reports of his behaving erratically and getting drunk on Jack Daniels. Gerald Corrigan, the president of the New York Fed, had taken the lead in encouraging Wall Street to connect with the Soviet reformers, something the Bush administration wanted to see happen. So when Yeltsin came to town, the New York Fed invited him to speak at a dinner of some 50 bankers, financiers, and corporate chiefs. Yeltsin arrived with a large entourage, and Corrigan and I talked with him briefly before he was introduced to the assembled dinner guests. The Yeltsin we met that night was no drunken buffoon. He seemed smart and determined. At the podium, he spoke cogently on reform for 20 minutes without notes and then answered detailed, specific questions from the audience without calling on his advisors for help. It was increasingly unclear whether Gorbachev or anyone could end the communist regime without causing a complete collapse into violence. After Gorbachev dissolved the Warsaw Pact in June and launched his plan to reconstitute the USSR as a voluntary confederation of democratic states, the resistance facing him became brutally apparent. In August, a coup attempt by Stalinist hardliners almost brought him down. To many, it was only the inspired theatrics of Yeltsin, who climbed on a tank outside the Soviet parliament, that enabled Gorbachev to survive. The West started looking for ways to help. That was the reason Treasury Secretary Nick Brady and I led a team to Moscow in September to meet with Gorbachev and confer with his economic advisors. Our ostensible mission was to assess what reforms were needed for the Soviet Union to join the International Monetary Fund, but mainly we wanted to see for ourselves what was going on. From the perspective of the Fed and the Western world, in purely economic terms, the Soviet Union was not much of a concern. Its economy wasn't that large. Of course, there were no reliable statistics, but experts estimated its GDP to be about the same size as the United Kingdom's, or about one-sixth the size of all Europe's. The Iron Curtain had kept it so isolated that its share of world trade was small. So was the amount of debt it owed Western nations, which might be subject to default if the government collapsed. But none of this took into account nuclear warheads. We were all acutely aware of the danger a Soviet collapse could pose to the world's stability and safety. For that reason alone, we were horrified by the picture that emerged during our stay. It was clear that the government was falling apart. The institutions of central planning were all beginning to fail, and the well-being of the population was threatened. Edward Shevardnadze, who was then foreign minister, told us of unrest in the Soviet republics along Russia's border. He said the lives of the 25 million ethnic Russians living in those regions could be in jeopardy. Worse, he said, was the risk that Russia and Ukraine, which both held weapons from the Soviet nuclear arsenal, might end up at odds. The economic data, which were fragmentary at best, were equally alarming. Inflation was out of control, with prices going up by anywhere from 3% to 7% a week. This was because all of the central mechanisms of production and distribution were breaking down, and more money was chasing fewer and fewer goods. In an effort to keep things moving at all, the government was flooding the economy with cash. A Gorbachev aide told me, "The printing presses can't keep up. We are printing rubles 24 hours a day." Over all this hung the shadow of not being able to put food on the shelves. There had been times in the past when the output of Ukraine had made it famous as the breadbasket of the world. But while harvests were still relatively bountiful, some of the crops had rotted in the fields because there was no way to collect and distribute the produce and grain. Soviet grain purchases from abroad were up to 40 million tons a year. Bread shortages were a sore point in the national memory. It was the bread riots of 1917, when the old women of St. Petersburg rose up in rebellion, that helped bring about the fall of the Tsar. A separate conversation gave me a glimpse of how brittle this economy was and how difficult it would be to change. Boris Nemtsov, a reformist economist, confided, "Let me tell you about military cities," and rattled off names I'd never heard of. Across the nation, Nemtsov explained, were at least 20 cities, each of 2 million people or more, that had been built around military plants. They were isolated and specialized and had no reason to exist other than to serve the Soviet military. His point was clear. Ending the Cold War and shifting to a market economy would leave entire cities and millions of workers with little to do and no ready way to adapt. The rigidity built into the Soviet economic system was far more extreme than any we'd encountered in the West. Among the many worries was that, in order to survive, these military workers, who included world-class scientists and engineers and technicians, would eventually have to sell their skills to rogue states. There were more briefings, but the message was the same. When we met with President Gorbachev and he repeated his goal of making the nation a major trading force in the world, I admired his courage. But in the margin of my notepad, I jotted down, USSR is a Greek tragedy waiting to happen. Grigory Yavlinsky, chief economist for Gorbachev's Council of Ministers, led a delegation in October 1991 to Thailand, where the World Bank and International Monetary Fund were holding their annual meeting. This was a truly historic moment, the first time Soviet officials had ever sat down with the key economic policymakers of the capitalist world. The Soviet Union had already been granted provisional status, formally giving it access to IMF and World Bank advice, but not to loans. Yavlinsky and his team came to argue that the Confederation of Remaining Soviet Republics ought to be accorded full membership. The question of massive Western loans was not immediately on the table. The Soviets insisted they could manage the transition to a market economy themselves, and none of the G7 nations was offering. The discussions lasted 2 full days, and if I had to pick a word to describe what the Western central bankers and finance ministers felt, it would be impotence. We knew that what was left of the Soviet Union was crumbling. We knew the armed forces hadn't been paid and that a collapse of the military could pose a serious threat to world peace. We had grave concerns about what would happen to the nuclear weapons. The deterioration was internal and political. All the IMF could do was talk about money, and money wasn't the problem. We ended up doing what organizations usually do under such circumstances. We delegated a committee for further study and discussion. In this instance, the deputy finance ministers of the G7 were to go to Moscow in a few weeks for consultations. So, it was up to the Soviet reformers. The challenges they faced were more difficult than those that had confronted their counterparts in Eastern Europe. The Polish and Czech leaders had been able to draw on the goodwill of the population. As trying as the economic circumstances may have been, their nations were being liberated from Moscow's grasp. But many Soviet citizens had prided themselves on their country's superpower status and had sacrificed much to help achieve it. For them, the upheavals meant nothing but sorrow, a great loss of national prestige. Humiliation made the reformers' tasks much harder. What's more, too many years had gone by in the Soviet Union since 1917. Scarcely anyone alive even remembered private property or had first-hand business experience or training. There were no accountants, auditors, financial analysts, marketers, or commercial lawyers, even among retirees. In Eastern Europe, where communism had reigned for 40 years instead of 80, free markets could be restored. In the Soviet Union, they had to be resurrected from the dead. Gorbachev did not stay in power long enough to oversee the market reforms. He resigned in December 1991, as the Soviet Union formally broke up and was replaced by a loose economic confederation of former Soviet republics. End of the Soviet Union. Gorbachev, last Soviet leader, resigns. U.S. recognizes republic's independence, read the headline of the New York Times on December 26th. I looked at it and felt regret that Ayn Rand hadn't lived to see it. She and Ronald Reagan had been among the few who had predicted decades before that the USSR would ultimately collapse from within. The man Boris Yeltsin chose to launch economic reforms in Russia was Yegor Gaidar. In the 1980s, when he and other young economists had dreamed of creating a market economy in the Soviet Union, they'd imagined an organized, methodical transition. But now, amid growing chaos, there was no time for that. Unless the government could jumpstart the markets, people might starve. So, in January 1992, Gaidar, as Russia's acting prime minister, turned to the scheme that had worked in Poland, abruptly ending price controls. Shock therapy jolted the Russians much more than it had the Poles. The size of the country, the system's rigidity, the fact that the state had dictated prices for people's entire lives, it all worked against them now. Inflation rose so fast that people's wages, when they could collect them, became worthless, and their meager savings were wiped out. The ruble lost 3/4 of its value in 4 months. Goods remained in scarce supply in the stores, and the black market flourished. Then, in October, Yeltsin and his economists unleashed the second massive reform. They issued vouchers to 144 million citizens and started privatizing state-owned enterprises and real estate on a massive scale. This reform, too, was far less effective than in Eastern Europe. Millions of people ended up with stock in businesses or owning their apartments, which was the goal, but millions more were bilked out of their vouchers. Entire industries ended up in the hands of a small number of opportunists who came to be known as the oligarchs. Like Jay Gould and some of the railroad tycoons in 19th-century America who built vast fortunes in part by manipulating government land grants, the oligarchs constituted an entirely new wealthy class and compounded the political chaos. I was fascinated to see these events unfold. Economists have had considerable experience observing how market economies convert to centrally planned ones. Indeed, the shift toward communism in the East and socialism in the West was the dominant economic trend of the 20th century. Yet until recent years, we have had little exposure to movement in the opposite direction. Until the wall fell and the need to develop market economies out of the rubble of Eastern Europe's central planning regimes became apparent, few economists had been thinking about the institutional foundations that free markets need. Now, unintentionally, the Soviets were performing an experiment for us, and some of the lessons were startling. The collapse of central planning did not automatically establish capitalism, contrary to the rosy predictions of many conservative-leaning politicians. Western markets have a vast underpinning of culture and infrastructure that has evolved over generations. Laws, conventions, behaviors, and business professions and practices for which there was no need in a centrally planned state. Forced to make the shift overnight, the Soviets achieved not a free market system, but a black market one. Black markets, with their unregulated prices and open competition, seemingly replicate what goes on in a market economy, but only in part. They are not supported by the rule of law. There is no right to own and dispose of property backed up by the enforcement power of the state. There are no laws of contract or bankruptcy, and no opportunity to take disputes to court for resolution. The linchpin of a free market economy, property rights, is missing. The result is that black markets bring few of the benefits to society of legally sanctioned trade. Knowing that the government will protect one's property encourages citizens to take business risks, a prerequisite of wealth creation and economic growth. Few will risk their capital if the rewards are going to be subject to arbitrary seizure by the government or mobsters. By the mid-1990s, that was the picture across much of Russia. For generations of people who had been brought up on the Marxist notion that private property is theft, the shift to a market economy already challenged their sense of right and wrong. Marx was hardly the first to condemn private ownership. The notion that private property is sinful, along with profit-making and lending an interest, has deep roots in Christianity, Islam, and other religions. Only with the Enlightenment did countervailing principles emerge to provide a moral basis for ownership and profit. John Locke, the great 17th-century British philosopher, wrote of the natural right of every individual to life, liberty, and estate. Such thinking profoundly influenced America's founding fathers and helped foster free market capitalism in the United States. The rise of the oligarchs further undermined popular support. From the start, law enforcement in defense of private ownership was extremely uneven. Private security forces, to a large extent, took over the job, sometimes warring with each other and further aggravating the sense of chaos. It wasn't at all clear that the Yeltsin government itself understood how a market economy's legal system must work. In 1998, for instance, an influential Russian academic told the Washington Post, "The state thinks private capital should be defended by those who have it. It's a completely conscious policy of the law enforcement authorities to remove themselves from defending private capital." To me, this suggested a basic ignorance of the need to embody property rights in the judicial system. The use of rival private police forces is not the rule of law, it is the rule of fear and force. Trust in the word of others, especially strangers, was another element conspicuously lacking in the new Russia. We hardly ever think about this facet of market capitalism, yet it is crucial. Despite each person's right in the West to file a lawsuit to address a perceived grievance, if more than a small fraction of contracts were adjudicated, our courts would be swamped to the point of paralysis. In a free society, the vast majority of transactions are thus, of necessity, voluntary. Voluntary exchange, in turn, presupposes trust. I have always been impressed that in Western financial markets, transactions involving hundreds of millions of dollars often are simply oral agreements that get confirmed in writing only at a later date, and at times after much price movement. But trust has to be earned. Reputation is often the most valuable asset a business has. The fall of the Soviet Union concluded a vast experiment. The long-standing debate about the virtues of economies organized around free markets and those governed by centrally planned socialism is essentially at an end. To be sure, there are still a few who support old-fashioned socialism. But what the vast majority of the remaining socialists now advocate is a highly diluted form, often called market socialism. I am not alleging that the world is about to embrace market capitalism as the only relevant form of economic and social organization. Vast numbers of people still consider capitalism, with its emphasis on materialism, degrading. And one can seek material well-being and yet view competitive markets as subject to excessive manipulation by advertisers and marketers who trivialize life by promoting superficial and ephemeral values. Some governments, such as that of China, even now attempt to override the evident preferences of their citizens by limiting their access to foreign media, which they fear will undermine their culture. Finally, there remains a latent protectionism, in the United States and elsewhere, which could emerge as a potent force against international trade and finance and the free market capitalism they support, particularly if today's high-tech world economy should falter. Nonetheless, the verdict on central planning has been rendered, and it is unequivocally negative. Chapter 7. A Democrat's Agenda. On the evening of February 17, 1993, I found myself in the uncomfortable glare of the TV lights at a joint session of Congress, sitting between Hillary Clinton and Tipper Gore. The front row of the gallery was not exactly where I'd expected to be for President Clinton's first major congressional address. I had assumed that my invitation to sit with the First Lady was a matter of courtesy and that I'd be at the back of the box with White House aides. I guess it was nice to know that the Federal Reserve was considered a valuable national asset after the somewhat less than favorable embrace we'd gotten from President Bush, but obviously I'd been positioned up front for a political purpose. Mrs. Clinton was wearing a bright red suit, and as the president spoke, the cameras focused on us again and again. Afterward, it turned out that not everyone had been pleased to see me there, on the grounds that it might compromise the independence of the Fed. I had no intention of doing that, of course, but I was intent on building a working relationship with this president, who seemed seriously fiscally responsible. I'd met Clinton in early December, when he was president-elect. He hadn't moved to Washington yet, so seeing him meant flying out to Little Rock, Arkansas. He and his transition team had set up shop there in the governor's mansion, which turned out to be a big red brick building with white pillars set on acres of flat lawn and gardens near the center of town. As I was ushered into an anteroom, I wasn't sure what to expect. One thing I'd heard, though, was that he always ran late, so I'd brought along some economic reports to read and busied myself for 20 minutes or so until he appeared. "Mr. Chairman," he said, striding toward me, smiling and reaching to shake hands. I could see why he was reputed to be a great retail politician. He made me believe he really had been looking forward to seeing me. Clinton had outlined a broad, ambitious economic agenda during his campaign. He wanted to cut taxes on the middle class, halve the federal deficit, stimulate job growth, increase U.S. competitiveness through new education and training programs, invest in the nation's infrastructure, and more. I had seen, and been part of, too many presidential campaigns. Candidates promised something for everybody. But I wondered what Clinton's real priorities were. He must have been reading my mind. One of the first things he said was, "We need to set our economic priorities, and I'm interested in your outlook on the economy." From the Fed's perspective, if you wanted to address the economy's long-term health, the deficit was by far the most pressing concern. I'd made that argument at the start of Bush's term, and now the problem was 4 years worse. The national debt held by the public had risen to $3 trillion, causing interest payments to become the third largest federal expense after Social Security and defense. So when Clinton asked for my economic assessment, I was ready with a pitch. Short-term interest rates were rock-bottom low. We'd cut them to 3%, and the economy was gradually shaking off the effects of the credit crunch and growing at a fairly reasonable pace, I told him. More than 1 million net new jobs had been created since the beginning of 1991. But long-term interest rates were still stubbornly high. They were acting as a brake on economic activity by driving up the costs of home mortgages and bond issuance. They reflected an expectation of ongoing inflation, for which investors had come to require an extra margin of interest to offset the added uncertainty and risk. Improve investors' expectations, I told Clinton, and long-term rates could fall, galvanizing the demand for new homes and the appliances, furnishings, and the gamut of consumer items associated with home ownership. Stock values, too, would rise as bonds became less attractive and investors shifted into equities. Businesses would expand, creating jobs. All told, the latter part of the 1990s could look awfully good. I was not oblivious of the fact that 1996 would be a presidential election year. The path to a beneficent future, I told the president-elect, was lowering the long-term trajectory of federal budget deficits. To my delight, Clinton seemed fully engaged. He seemed to pick up on my sense of urgency about the deficit and asked a lot of smart questions that politicians usually don't ask. Our meeting, which had been scheduled for an hour, turned into a lively discussion that went on for almost three. We touched on a whole range of topics beyond economics, Somalia and Bosnia and Russian history, job training programs, education, and he asked for my assessment of world leaders whom he hadn't yet had a chance to meet. After a while, aides brought in lunch. So saxophone wasn't the only thing we had in common.